Okay? I can change my behavior. I can change what I say and what I do. And I have this wonderful woman who's my wife. We've been together a long time. And she hates me to use the F word. And so I've been in AA most of my life. That is what we say about a lot of things. So I really try. And when she said, you know, when you say that word, I just don't like it. It just sounds disrespectful to me, and I just kind of cringe. And I'd really like you to stop saying that word. And I said, I can work on that. I will stop saying that word around you. But sometimes, if my brain gets away from me, which it can do, and it comes flying out, it's like, trust me, I'll know it. And I'll work harder next time. Is that okay? And she goes, yeah, that's okay. Let me see. How long did that just take? 30 seconds? That was about as long as it took. That was simple. I can change what I say. I can change what I do. I cannot, and even if I could, I wouldn't change who I am. I am who I am. That's all there is to it. I can change how I express that. I can change what I say and what I do. So a talking boundary is this. When you say this, this is what you do with relationships, okay? I feel this way. Now, if I'm in relationship, whether I'm his mom, her spouse, her daughter, her sister, his sister, her niece, whatever, right? If I care about them, I may be interested in their reality about that, whatever I say or do, right? So I might ask about it. Can you give me more information about that? That's all. And if they say no, okay, I know what no means. It means that's a boundary. Okay. Hooray. They're taking care of themselves, right? If they ask me, well, would you please tell me what you know, what that's about? I can tell them that too. But the bottom line is that I'll make a decision, what I say, what I do. And I can ask you to change what you say and what you do. And I will tell you how I feel about it. And then I will ask you to do something different. That's the part that sometimes people don't think all the way through. Because if somebody asks you, or you want somebody to change their behavior, you really need to know what you want them to change it to. It's not like, I want you to change that, now guess what I want? That doesn't sound very adult, right? But if you're real clear about it, I really don't like it when you do that, and I feel this way when you do it, and I'd like you to do that in the future. Like, say, for instance, when you say you're going to pick me up at 5, and I notice that 3 out of 5 times you pick me up at 5:30, I feel some anger and some fear about that. And you can even tell more. I feel angry because I don't think, you know, here's what I'm making up in my mind, the story, okay? Is that I'm making up that you don't think that my time is as valuable as yours, and I feel fear that something's happened. And in that 15 minutes while I'm waiting, I don't want to feel that way. So, in the future, I'd like you to really consider when you're going to be there and tell me that time. See, that took about 45 seconds. And if that person really cares about you, it's like, oh, that's easy. So I just thought I was, you know, I thought I'd just tell you 5:15 because that covered it. It's like, no. It might cover it for some people, but maybe not for me. So does that make sense? The rest of it is just, you know, it's just noise, what everybody else is doing, unless you feel threatened. So like, when I go back to the scene of the crime, because I was talking about that, when I go back to the scene of the crime, my mother's still alive, and my wounded siblings are all still wounded, and their children are now wounded. And I come from a big Mormon family, a very big, big Mormon family. And when you get that much dysfunction together, it's like nuclear dysfunction. And it can be challenging. And so, but what's happened? Okay, so the gifts, right? So what has happened over time is that when I was first young and I was in my addiction, my drug and alcohol and sex addiction, love addiction, you know, God, you name it. If I could distract myself, I was doing it. So back in those days, I really was the identified patient, the crazy one. The OG, if she'd just come back to church, then, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I got a recovery, and it's been about, it's been almost 40 years. And and what's happened over time is that a couple of them have dabbled in recovery, but nobody's really made a commitment to it. And so here's this nuclear dysfunction going on over here. And they see me now as the well one, okay? So they all try and act better when I'm around because it doesn't work. It doesn't work to do what always was done, which was, well, we'll... You know, they don't think the people don't do these things on purpose. It's just that it's just a matter of this is how the family was, and so when she's here, then it causes the family to do this, right? It's a system. And so when I was in the family, I was the one over here bouncing up and down, going, "Hey, there's something really wrong with this family," and of course nobody noticed, nobody cared. And so I was the identified person, right? The sick one, the sick one, okay? The sinful one later. And so now, in my recovery, because I do have boundaries, when I go there, I don't talk to them about my recovery. Are you kidding? You know, it's like, that's like walking in and saying, "Okay, everybody, take your best shot." It's like, my recovery belongs to me. It's part of my self-contained system. But what it does, and what it can do for everybody, is you can actually go back to the scene of the crime and stay sane. And if you have really good boundaries, you can start to notice that, wow, these people are really great. Now, you know, part of my boundary system, which I kind of enjoy, actually, I have to tell you, is that I have a running dialogue or monologue or whatever that is that I'm talking to myself. And sometimes I guess it's a dialogue. But sometimes it's just a monologue. I have this running, you know, editorial about what I see and what I hear going on in my nuclear dysfunction family. And it goes something like this. Oh, there's my mother. She's going to bake 5 or 6 cakes tonight. And she wants... This is how she loves me. She wants to bake all these cakes, and she wants me to eat them all. Isn't it a wonder that there are eating disorders all over in our family? Isn't that interesting? Good night, Mom. I'll see you in the morning. I get up the next day, 6 cakes. And I go, wow, looks like you were busy last night. Well, I got up. I couldn't sleep, and I just thought, well, I'll just bake these cakes for you. And I, well, that was very thoughtful. Thank you very much. I think I'll have some oatmeal. Right? Oh, I have oatmeal too. Okay. Fix. That was really good oatmeal. Now, see, in our Clean Plate Club family, leaving those cakes would have been sinful, right? But there they still are. 4 days later, I'm walking, see you, Mom. Yeah, it was really nice to have this visit with you. I love you. I care about you. I hope that you're well, and I'll call you next week. But what about the cake? Probably someone will die this week, and you can take them all over there. Because that always happens, right? There are some things you can just count on. So she's like, okay, bye, honey. just laughing. Well, that was a lot of fun. It's like being on Saturday Night Live at that place. So boundaries can be fun. Just think about it. It's the hardest thing for people to do because, oh, we want to get in there and tell them. We really want to tell them how it works, right? These are the people that created the nightmare, that created our codependence, that creates the nightmare in our relationships. They didn't mean to, for the most part. They didn't mean to. They did the best they could. That doesn't mean you have to buy into the bullshit, every time you go there. You just don't have to. So I actually wrote down some boundaries, self-containment boundaries for family of origin when you go there. Because that's when, usually that's when it really falls to pieces. You know, I have people go through legacy and they get this thing, I got my boundaries on board and I've got it, you know, and they come back and go, oh God, I spent all that time and energy and money trying to do legacy and look at this, how my boundaries went crazy, you know, I don't have them now. Like, okay, well, if you're not thinking about them, they're not there anyway. And so you have to be thinking about them. And so what I say about your family of origin and boundaries, okay, you're in codependence recovery. Hooray for you. Your life will continue to improve. You will feel more and more joy. You'll feel more and more energy. People will start to notice that you feel, that you look happy, that you look better, that you kind of like light up a room and it's cool because you're yourself, your real self that you were supposed to be. Do not share this good news of recovery with your family of origin. Don't do it. And then don't tell them about the really wrong path that they've been going down. That will blow up in your face. Then you're going to sound like the crazy person they always thought you were. And please don't use talking boundaries with people that aren't in recovery. They just don't get it. I mean, it sounds reasonable. Oh, when you do this, I feel this, and I'd like you to change it and do it this way. That's not complicated. But unless you have know what's going on, it's like that talking boundary is a two-way street. And if they're not using them, they just think you're like trying to manipulate them, you're trying to get controlling. You sound like you've been in therapy, and that must be what your therapist says. You know, they just don't, they're not there. So don't do that. You have to pay attention when you're around these people. This is the scene of the crime. You have to pay attention so you don't get triggered back into your wounded child, back into your adapted adult child. You don't want to be feeling 13 years old back at the scene of the crime. You want to be able to be your adult self. So you have strong boundaries. And remember that these relationships with your family members, they're complicated. They're really complicated. And they get more complicated on that side of the street when you're in recovery. Sometimes they just don't know what to do with you. Because you've changed the rules. And you can't tell them about it because they won't understand. But, you know, you have to remember this about recovery. I'll just tell you a little story. So I've gotten a few degrees in my life. And I remember the first one I got, my bachelor's degree. It was a freaking miracle. I didn't know what a university or college was. I grew up on an Indian reservation, and that wasn't the topic of conversation. We'll just put it that way. And even though we were Mormons, we were, you know, girls were supposed to grow up and have children and get married in the temple, and that was it. So no one ever said, gee, Donna, you think you might want to go to college? So when I got this degree, I was beyond ecstatic, right? Until I read it. Rules, rights and responsibilities. I'm going, responsibilities? This was supposed to set me free. Here's what happens. When you are given the opportunity to grow yourself, to learn more, to be able to feel better, then you simply have more responsibility when you are around others to be aware that they're not doing this recovery work. All right? So having some compassion that they're still, you know, in a lot of misery. They're still struggling. That doesn't mean we got to get in there and fix them. It's never worked. It doesn't mean that we got to now do it with them. We got to go back and be who they think we should be. We got to return to our old self. It just means that we have more responsibility. And simply put, we've got to have boundaries and recognize that they're going to be exactly who they are. I remember, well, let's see, my son was about 5, so I was maybe in my mid-40s, okay? And I had to have this pretty serious surgery. And I had a, well, he was 4. So I had a 4-year-old at home. I was a single mom. And I was having this pretty serious surgery that was going to lay me up, right? And at that time, I didn't know very many people because I hadn't lived in Seattle very long. So I wasn't sure what I was going to do. So I did what any person would. I called my family. Hey, I'm having this surgery. It kind of is going to happen right away. And so I just thought I'd let you know, is there any way that somebody could give me a hand? Well, you know, we got Memorial Day coming up, and that's when we all go out to the reservation and brand cows. And, yeah, I just don't think we can, no one's around, Donna. Right? No one's around. And so my wounded ego state, child ego state, shows up. They hate me. They always hate me. They're not there. Well, they aren't. So I was feeling, you know, I was having a regular pity party for myself. Crap. No one loves me. So I called my friend Pia. I said, Pia, blah, blah, blah. I told her my sad story. And she said, okay, first of all, I'll be up. And I said, oh, gee, really? And she goes, yeah. And what were you expecting? It was the second thing. What were you expecting exactly? It sounds to me like they were doing exactly the same thing they've done since the day you were born. And it was like, oh, yeah, they're not in recovery. I am. And for that moment that I, like, put it out there to the people who have never been there for me, hello, is there some reason that some miracle has happened and now they're going to all, like, rise to the occasion? I don't think so. There are rules about getting their help. Okay? Same rules that Mormons have, you know, that thing about taking care of each other. If you go by the rules, and I don't go by the rules, so guess what? But it was just that moment of clarity that, yeah, they're acting exactly the way they always do. Of course. What else would they be doing? I've been changing, so I'm not always acting the way I'm, you know, I'm not acting the way I used to, except I was in that moment. As soon as I put it out there, I was acting just like I used to. Well, how about now? Well, how about now? Well, how about now? No, no, no. You're wrong. You're homosexual. We don't help people like you. Right? No. So, when you have boundaries, making decisions about who I ask. Making decisions about who I share things with. Not them. The other thing you have to remember with your family of origin, this is, you know, this, some of you have probably experienced this. The weller you get, the sicker they look. And here's how it goes. You're on a path. You've been going down this path with them. Crazy, crazy, crazy. Now, you're going on this path. They're still going on this path. And they go year after year, year after year. Now you're going on this path, year after year after year. How close is this now? It's not going to get better. in terms of, well, now they'll finally love me, now they'll finally recognize, now they'll finally be there. No. The longer you're on this path, the longer they're on this path, the sicker and crazier they look, and that's just fact. Because this codependency thing isn't something you just get better from. Age doesn't get you better. Wishing it doesn't get you better. You get on a different path, and after a while you notice, I'm thinking different, I feel better. They're still figuring out what's wrong with Donna. But she's the only one. This truly did happen. We had a crisis in our family, a huge, pretty huge one. And I got this kind of group call. You're the only one we trust to help us. Okay, well, I am the adult. And this is another reality about your family of origin. They're yours. They're yours, and they aren't going anywhere. And so what happens is that they start to notice that indeed you are the only one they can trust, because you do exactly what you say you're going to do over and over and over again. You're not trying to change them. Your life just gets better. The only time they hear from you is when you're ready, when you want to. They start to trust you, and that's just kind of weird. It's kind of weird. You have to, like what I said, you have to be aware of your intentions when you interact with them. Do some soul searching to make sure that you don't have some kind of intention of, okay, this is the time. This is the time that they're going to love me. Now, you know, I remember when I called my mother and said, hey, I'm getting my doctorate this month. Oh, that's nice, honey. Let me know how it works out. Okay. Thanks. I was pretty much, I mean, I was in recovery, and I got off the phone, and I just thought, news, weather, sports. Yep, that's what we do. And I say that many times to people that I work with. I say, now you've got to talk news, weather, and sports with this. What? These people are my family. Yeah, that's why you need to just talk about news, weather, and sports. To protect yourself. And be careful, because you might be sitting there, you know, having dinner and things are going well because you've got boundaries and you know what you're doing and you're making decisions about what you're saying, what you're doing with them. And you might think, well, they're really acting okay. They seem to be fine. Now I can just start to put it out there a little bit. Don't do that. They're doing okay because they're not in distress about you changing. They just don't need, they don't want to hear about it. You be yourself and it goes fine. You try and tell them about it, explain about it, try and get them to do it, blows up in your face. Okay. Let's see, just a few more things here and then we'll have a little break. The other thing is that always have boundaries with children. Always. Remember that children are always acting their age. And if you're an adult, when there's children around, you really have to act your age. They are trusting you. They see you as a grown-up whether you do or not. Because you're bigger. And you talk better. And you have a beard. Okay? And you have glasses. And they see you as an adult. Act like one. Have boundaries with children. Always. Stay in your functional adult reality when you're playing with children. You know, you're not a kid. They have friends for that. Okay? So when you're playing with children, you want to stay in your adult reality. Have some fun. But remember who the kid is, because they're relying on you. And if you think back, you know, if there were any functional adults in your family or in your life, the ones that you look back on, for the most part, the ones you look back on and you think, wow, that person was really there for me, you think of them and they're the ones that were acting like adults. Right? They were the ones that, you know, that teacher that made you get your homework done whether you wanted to or not and required you to show up on time. Now, if they're not in their functional adult, yeah, you can come in whenever you want. Hey, man, we're having a good time in this classroom. That's probably not the one you look back on as being that one. Because so many times, if you come from a family that abandons, abuses, or neglects you, sometimes you can find even another adult somewhere that was, you know, I had a gym teacher. Of course I did. I had a gym teacher who was my hero. And yes, she was one of us, but that was back in the day when, oh, that wasn't acceptable. But she was there for me. She knew what was happening, and there was no way for her to intervene with that, because that was before there were rules about hurting kids. And so she was kind to me. She required me to do the things that were necessary for her class. She would ask me questions, how are you doing? You want to come in here and talk to me about what's going on? Of course I didn't, but it was like, sure, I'll sit down here and talk to you. And it's, oh, okay. She didn't like get in there and like, let's be buddies. Like, I didn't need any more buddies. My buddies were my friends, my peer group. If you have children, stay in your functional adult. They don't need you to be their best friend. That's part of their development, just like it was part of your development, to feel safe enough with the grown-ups in your life that you could venture out into the world of peer relationships. It is a scary place. And it's always good to know that you have these functional adults here that don't act like you when you're trying to figure it out. So that's a boundary that you have with children. Always let the kid win when they're young. Not like, oh, I'll just throw the game. But, oh, really? You want to beat a kid in checkers when they're 6 years old? Who's going to win that? And what does that make you happy? It's okay for them to win. And the older they get, you just give them a little more challenge. But, you know, it's okay for them to win. It makes them feel good about themselves. And that's what, I mean, wouldn't you have liked that when you were young? To play checkers and, gosh, you just won. And what, you know, and your parents or whoever's really working hard and they go, there you did it. You did it again. You just beat me again. You're really smart. And you just, that's called building self-esteem. Yeah. And then if you have adult children, remember this. They're on their own path. Once they have gone off to college, really, or, you know, they've left home, they are now on their own path. Anything you thought you could impact them as far as being a parent now has more to do with how you behave than anything you can say to them. And they don't want to hear from you anyway unless they ask. Right? When you were trying to get away, did you want a grown-up to sit there and tell you what to do and how to do it? You were trying to figure it out, but you wanted to know they were there. So if you did have questions, there was somebody you could count on to be a functional adult. Of course, you weren't thinking that at the time, but it's like, Wouldn't it be nice if at the end of the day, no matter what happened, you knew there was at least one person, maybe more, that could just, you knew that they had wisdom, you knew that what they said was true, that they wouldn't lie to you, that they wouldn't blow smoke, but they were kind and helpful and loving. Helpful. They're on their own path. And if you have adult children, you can just be that person in the background. They know you're there. And if you've raised them in recovery, they're kind of infected with it. And they're going to have self-esteem. They will not have trouble knowing their reality. They will know what moderation is. They will not have childhood needs that have now morphed and look like adult needs because their childhood needs were met. And now they're done. So now they're busy trying to figure out how they're going to get their adult needs met and how they're going to get their adult wants met. So they're infected with it anyway. They're still going to struggle. Life is a struggle. It's difficult. And then you can use talking boundaries with them because they probably grew up with it. I mean, if you're in recovery, you were probably telling your five-year-old, when you spit on me, I feel sad. I really wish you wouldn't do that anymore. The kid, okay. Right? You're just learning when you're a child. You're just learning. Everything you do is brand new. Spitting, not acceptable, but I'm going to try it again. Uh-huh, because you're a child. If you're an adult, if it feels bad, don't do it. Don't do it again. Don't do it again. Don't do it again. That's what children do. They got to figure it out, work it out. Okay, so now you know what the really big core issues are. How did it happen? I told you how it happened. You grew up in families that were less than nurturing. You were either abandoned and or abused and or neglected. Here, now I've told you what codependence is. All of those things I talked about. And some of it, I talked about some of the ways that you can be in recovery. And I'll just say these things again. And these pink sheets, this is my way of saying gay pride. Because it's too cold for me to take my sweatshirt off. Otherwise, I have my pride shirt on underneath. But these are some basic, really basic ideas about how you can be in recovery, stay in recovery every single day, things you can do every day. You can see there's not much because I like the simple thing. So you can each have one of these. I hope there's enough. I was trying to make it be enough. And if there isn't, I'm sure you can share and get it. So I have these available after I'm finished. The other thing that people asked me about was the legacy workshop that I do that I mentioned. It's 4 days. And I am in recovery for codependence. I don't work weekends. I only do my 12-step work on weekends. That's what I'm doing today. But when I'm doing my legacy workshop, I'm working. So it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. What I suggested was that if people were asking me, well, coming to Seattle to do the legacy workshop, and you can go on my website, and I usually post the next one, usually 2 in advance of when they'll be. I would also like to say that if there are enough people in Portland, like 5 or 6 people in Portland that would be interested in participating in a legacy workshop, I would be happy to come down here and do one. If there were 6 people, 5 or 6 people got together and wanted me to come down and do one, I would do one here. So just to answer that question. What I do in the legacy workshop, is kind of similar to Survivor's Workshop, and not to say anything negative about the Survivor's Workshop, because I worked on that with Pia and Pat Melody back in the early 80s for the Meadows. And what I have been told is that, like, the Survivors is kind of like Legacy Light. I think that's kind of funny. Because, you know, when you start something, you just know it. Really know it. And so taking people through it is like a dance to me. And, it just moves. And for, yeah, I certainly don't need to sell it, because I have people signing up for it all the time. But I can tell you that if you want to, you know, kind of power through your childhood trauma, Survivor's Workshop or Legacy, give yourself a gift. It's worth about a year's worth of intensive therapy around your family of origin trauma. Okay? So now, I'm going to tell you a short version, a simple version, about how this childhood trauma affects your brain. Codependence is more than just something that happens to you in your development. That's a big part. But we now know that your brain is actually impacted by living in an environment where you feel unsafe as a child. What we know now, because of all of the wonderful studies that have been done in neuroscience and neurobiology, is that we know now that a healthy brain develops from the back, where the amygdala, fight, flight, or freeze, it develops from the back and it grows this way. Okay? This part is the fight, flight, or freeze. This part is also where your autonomic nervous system is controlled, where your heart remembers to beat, where your lungs remember to breathe, those kind of things. Where you feel hunger, and this part here is where your emotional regulation is. And most people that have codependency, I have yet to know anybody that has codependency that is not emotionally dysregulated. That's what part of it is. If you feel emotionally immature in an adult situation, you have emotional dysregulation. And that part of the brain happens here. This part of the brain we call the frontal lobe, or the executive functioning part of the brain. This part of the brain is where we think and make decisions. Now, when we're taking our emotions into consideration, then we say, oh, here's what my emotions are saying about that situation, so I can make a decision in this part of the brain about what to do. We know that when children are in an environment where they don't feel safe, their brain develops like this. It starts back here, but instead of developing up like that, where the emotional regulation becomes mature, it develops like this. Guess what doesn't get mature? Emotional regulation. And, you know, I was in a conference a few years ago, all psychiatrists, and if there are any here, hooray. But they were all standing up talking about this exciting brain research that they've been discovering. And one of the head guys said, this research is going to revolutionize the field of psychiatry and psychology. Because we now know that it's childhood trauma that causes mental illness. No shit. You don't just get this. I mean, yes, there can be, you know, there can be maybe some family, like, genetic predisposition, but nobody knows that for sure. What we know is that when a child feels unsafe, especially in the first 6 years of their lives, the development of the brain is impaired. And here's another thing that, you know, actually, Coda got a lot of credit at that conference. When people get in programs where they are encouraged to act like adults, when they are encouraged to stop themselves from melting down, to stop themselves from acting out, reacting, where they're trained to stop and think about what they're going to do next, their brain chemistry actually changes, and people get well. This is revolutionary. And what you're doing in your program is revolutionary. You will get weller and weller. Your brain chemistry will change. But it requires you to do the work. And that work is when you start bouncing around with self-esteem, you find the commonality right away. That changes your brain. Because when you are thinking I'm less than, you're in a shame attack, you feel bad about yourself. When you think about the ways that we are having, the things we have in common, your emotions stabilize. Okay. Oh, yeah. We put our pants on the same way. Yeah, we do. And we're both in this grocery store getting food. Oh, yeah, we are humans and we have to eat. And, oh, you know, when I'm in with my doctor, I realize they chose a different profession than me, but we all put our pants on the same way. They sit in their office doing what they do. I sit in my office doing what I do. And we're all healthcare providers. You know, it's like there is something in common with everybody. And every time you do that, you come right out of a shame attack. Why should I be ashamed? We're alike. We have value because we breathe. We're alike. So when you do that, that starts to change your brain. When you stop saying, I don't know, and when you stop thinking, I know, but I'm not going to tell you, what you're doing is you're saying, I know what I want. If you ask me, do you want to eat? I will go, yes. Or I will say, no. Or I will say, in about an hour and a half. I know when I'm hungry. Now, if I have an eating disorder, sometimes I get confused by that. But one of the things we train people to do when they have eating disorder that they're trying to be in recovery for is that it is 5 o'clock. Do you feel hungry? Think about it. When's the last time you ate? Do you feel like you kind of run down in your energy? Do you feel like you might want to go to sleep? Do you feel like hyper? It's like these are the things that we train people, and your brain changes. Then when you say, you stop saying, I know, but I'm not going to tell you, then you stop being passive aggressive. Because that's what people, when they're passive aggressive, that's what they do. Well, I know the answer to that question, but you're sure not going to know it. Part of it is that I may be trying to pull some kind of power play on you. Most of the time it's that I'm afraid you're going to judge me. Or that I think it's a trick question. Okay. Well, if I have a boundary and that is a trick question, I'm going, oh, that's goofy. Okay, whatever. And I'm done. So that's the second thing. The third thing is moderation. There is a middle. And I'm going to find out what it is. I'll ask the people who seem to know, the ones that actually act as if there's a middle. The fourth thing is that I'm going to identify what I think my adult needs and wants are. Needs, wants. What adults need. I'm going to ask somebody, a therapist. I'm going to ask a sponsor. I'm going to ask somebody that seems to have an idea about what needs and wants are. And at the end of the day, for functional adults, your needs list should be, oh, this big. Okay? We take care of our needs pretty much. Our wants might be this big. That gives us something to go for, to, you know, try for, to earn, whatever. But our needs, you know, food, shelter, clothing, might have need, social needs. We know that's really important because when people don't, are not social, they get kind of goofy. We have physical needs. You know, we have needs to be touched. All right? When you say, well, I have a need for unconditional love, or I have a need for honesty, or I have a need, it's like, okay, if you're paying attention to yourself, you know that when you have needs that can't be met, and how can you possibly make sure your needs for honesty are met? So I have a need to be aware on that, that's on me, right? Then I can tell what's going on. So needs, adult needs and wants. If your needs list is this long, you might want to get with somebody and find out, okay, some of those childhood needs might be put in there and they might not belong there. But if you want to take them out, put them over here on the wants list, or look at the ones that you can meet yourself. And then the last one is boundaries. It's a system of self-containment. A short version, when you're in a crisis, and it's like, believe me, there is no way that you're going to have boundaries enough that you're not going to be surprised sometimes, okay? Because who's thinking of boundaries 24/7? Nobody. So most of the time, you're not ready. If you're going to see your family of origin, think boundaries the whole time, and you'll be fine. But most of the time, we're just going around doing our lives. So a really easy, short way to get your boundaries on board when you need them fast is to think this, memorize this phrase. What you think and feel about me is none of my business. None of my business. The second I say I don't care, I've made it my business. None of my business. I'm just going to go off and do what I'm doing. You don't like me, it's like none of my business. The rest of the time it's what's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. I need to be paying attention to this first. Self-containment. I make decisions about what I say and what I do. And I am accountable for the impact. Period. Okay? So we get this way by growing up in families that are less than nurturing. We get this way when we're young and we're afraid and our brain doesn't develop correctly. It's just simple. If you grew up in a family that was nurturing, that was loving, that cared for you, and I'm not talking about the extreme where you got helicopter parents or that put you on a pedestal and give you all the responsibility of an adult. That is not nurturing. When you're a child, you need to be a child. You need to be treated like a child, and you need to feel safe. Okay, if you did not feel safe, then your brains did not develop correctly. And that's what creates codependence. Emotional immaturity. This part doesn't develop. It can get developed. How do you grow yourself up? Well, first of all, are there any addicts in the room besides me? Yay! Okay, so I go to this meeting on a mountain. I love it. And there's a guy there, and he tells this whole story about whatever, and he says, and then I remembered what my first sponsor told me. First thought wrong. And that is true. For everybody in this room, your first thought is probably wrong. Because it's your fallback position when you're not paying attention, you're going to get triggered. You're going to react. First thought wrong. That's a good thing to remember. Because if you realize first thought wrong, then you can keep your mouth shut. Keep your hands to yourself. Back up. Breathe. Okay, I want to be my age right now. So, what would an adult do? What would an adult do in this situation? So you're thinking about it. What you're doing is you're allowing yourself to have whatever feeling you're having, and you're making a decision, not reacting. I'm not saying you're going to make the best decision or the right decision. You know, unless the decision has long-term consequences, like somebody dies or something, it's probably going to be a growth opportunity anyway. But when you think, first thought wrong, because I'm gonna be reacting from that place where I'm emotionally immature, so I'll stop, I'll give myself a minute, and I'll say, what would a grown-up do? What would a grown-up do? It's that simple. And then you say, how many grown-ups do I know? I wonder what that person would do. Yeah, I wonder what Donna would do. She's a pretty good grown-up. Or you might say, I wonder what Ken and Mary would do. People you think have an idea about their being a functional adult, what would they do? That's what you do. And here's another thing. If it feels weird, you're on the right track. If it feels, oh yeah, I've done this before, well, you've done it before. And you're doing the same thing, expecting different results. And even Einstein said, that was crazy. That's the definition of insanity. I think he was a pretty smart guy. So if you feel like, oh, this feels uncomfortable, I don't know about, that's good. Stay on that. Because that means that you're creating new neural pathways. That means that your brain is doing something different than it did before. And cheer yourself on to do that. That's one of the ways you grow up. Say, if I feel real comfortable with this, I'm just doing the same thing. If I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'm probably doing something different. Now, you really notice this in relationships. Now, I didn't say this, but I will say it now. Is that all of the addictions, with the exception of love addiction, all of them are distractions from what's happening to you when you're a child and you feel afraid. Okay? Love addiction is a natural consequence of love addiction is a natural consequence of growing up in a family that is less than nurturing. And how does that happen? The love addict who doesn't have any other addiction, okay? Because most everybody has some kind of love addiction if they grew up in a family like that. But the ones who identify as their primary addiction, love addiction, they weren't distracting themselves at all. Well, they're kids growing up in families where they feel unsafe. It's like, okay, when I drink, I feel better. When I'm using drugs, I feel better. When I'm smoking cigarettes, I feel better. When I'm playing with myself, I feel better. When I'm having sex, I feel better. When I'm, you know, trying to get the best grades in school, I feel better. When I refuse to eat, I feel better. When I throw up, I feel better. You get what I mean? Kids start these addictions really early on. And the two primary addictions are sex and food. Okay, those are the ones that kids can start right away. And they do. But the kid that doesn't have a distraction, they are watching everything those parents are doing. And they're saying to themselves, and if you've ever said this, you know what I mean. I know they love me. I know they do. I just have to figure out what I need to do to get them to know it. I know they love me. I've just got to figure out the magic that gets them to notice it. What do love addicts do? I know you love me. And now I'm going to keep at you and keep at you until you know that, until you recognize it. That's why I'm still in this relationship, even though you tell me to leave, even though you tell me you don't want. And so, you know, I'm in here anyway. Here's what the love addict's doing. They're not distracting at all. And so it's a natural consequence. They just did this for 21 years. I'm watching every single thing you do, right? They're watching that for 21 or 25 years. And then it's really easy. Now I'm watching my first boyfriend. Now I'm watching my girlfriend. Now I'm watching my first husband. Now I'm, you know. And I'll do anything to get that love. That's what love addicts do. You're trained to do it. It's a natural consequence. So if you're an alcoholic, you're probably doing that too, because trust me, every kid that's in a family that doesn't feel safe and doesn't feel loved and cared for by their parents and is afraid of their parents sometimes or can't find them, they're out there doing 20 other things other than paying attention to me, being neglected, being abandoned, whatever it is. It's like every child is going to be trying to figure out, what can I do? Because if they don't love me, it's my fault. And I just have to figure out the magic that's going to get them to pay attention to me. Why do you think it's your fault? Because you're a child. And children are the center of their own universe. And your parents were like gods. They were your higher power, as they should have been. So here's another big surprise. People have a little trouble with that second and third step. Because their first experience with God wasn't so great. Yeah, I had that power greater than myself, and look what happened. I really count on that a lot, right? Because when you are young, those parents, they're your gods. And if they are responsible and recognize that, and they respect you, it's a pretty easy jump. It's not even a jump. When you get old enough to realize, well, my parents really are people. They're not God. But now I know there's something bigger, and I'll figure that out now. Not a big scary thing, but oh my gosh. Second, third step, that's a big one for most people. Because they didn't respect that. And as a child, you're the center of the universe. They're not loving you. They're not paying attention to you. They're not teaching you what to do and how to do it. They're not doing their job. And the only question you can think to ask is, what's wrong with me? Children don't say, what's wrong with them? They say, what's wrong with me? I have to find out what's wrong with me, and then I'll fix it. Now remember, for myself, the first time I was in a psychiatrist's office, oh, that was challenging. That was at the university. And they said to me, because I was challenged. I was young, and I was, you could say dysfunctional. And they said, well, if you're going to stay at this university, you're going to be in therapy every single week. As long as your feet are here, your butt's going to be there at least once a week. So I went to see this psychiatrist, and she said, tell me about your... She was actually, like, German. So she had that, like, why don't you tell me? Who are you? I'm 17, thinking, what the... So, just tell me about your relationship with your father. No. Tell me about your relationship with your mother. She's wonderful. That's all I'm saying. She kept asking me questions. I'm 17. Have you ever tried to talk to a 17-year-old who's upset? You get grunts. You get one word, you know, one word if you're lucky. And finally she said, well, what do you think the problem is? And I said, that's what you're here for, right? Everyone else seems to see that I have a problem and what the problem is, but no one will tell me. And if someone would just tell me what my problem is and what ways I'm broken, I'll just fix it. So why don't you tell me? Absolutely believe that. There must be something wrong with me. My parents hate me. My father's tried to kill me. My mother walks away. The church blames me. I'm not good enough. So somebody tell me. What's wrong with me? The harder I try, the worse it gets. Does this ring any bells for anybody? Yeah. Tell me about your relationship with your father. No. So she was useless, and I went back to the dean, and I said, I'm not going back to see her. And so he sent me to a Rogerian. And at least that person just sat there and said, oh, I can see that you're feeling hurt. I can see that you're feeling angry. I would imagine that you're feeling upset. Okay, and that, you got a PhD for that? Okay, all right, we're good on that. But at least you didn't ask me questions. Because I believe that. And I know that every single person in this room believed that. There was something wrong with you. And that's why your parents abandoned you. And that's why your parents neglected you. And that's why your parents abused you. Or all of the above. And that's why whenever you went and tried to seek solace with somebody else, they might have done the same thing. You thought it was your fault. It was never your fault. Every single person in this room is a precious, wonderful human being. Yeah, that other thing was not true. And you absolutely have a right to start to know that on a very deep and real level, because that is really how you were born. It's your birthright to know that you have value just because you breathe. Don't ever let anyone tell you differently. If you're in relationship with people that keep telling you there's something wrong with you, that you're not good enough, those aren't people you need to be around. They're not telling you the truth. I'm as serious as a heart attack right now. I look at all of your faces, and I just see precious, precious people. Don't let anyone tell you differently. Don't let them treat you as if you're not precious. Here's the reality. When you're in a relationship with somebody that knows that you're precious, that knows that you have value because you breathe, they love you. They don't fight with you. It's not a struggle. Sure, two grown-ups trying to live in the same house together, maybe raise kids together, buy houses together, go on vacations. There might be a difference of opinion. But when you both agree and know and sense and feel your partner's wonderful, precious self, you just know it's a difference of opinion. And it takes about 30 seconds to figure out, what do we do? Because they don't have a need to be better than you. They don't have a need to put you down, to cuss at you, to swear at you, to yell at you. When they do, you're going to feel just like you used to when you're a child. Until you've been in recovery and you have boundaries and you go, that's not working out. That person doesn't seem to care about me. Because when people care about me, they're not threatening me. They're not yelling at me. They're not trying to hurt my feelings by saying mean things to me. And I'm not doing that to them either. And that's really the gift of recovery and codependence. Is that you really know that you have value because you breathe. So, I'm going to take questions now. Because that's all I've got to say. Thank you.